I said before, I work right across the street from the United Nations, which is a wonderful location to work. And a lot of international experience. It gives one a very different sense of being an American, being a U.S. citizen, being next to soil that is not technically U.S. territory, though it's certainly hard to realize that. Where the UN is, if anyone's seen the UN tucked in the middle of Manhattan, it doesn't seem like it's another international territory. And the title of today's session, which I sort of reversed from what appeared in the bulletin, is Can We Serve Two Masters, Patriotism and Dissent? I'd like to begin with the biblical quote from which that phrase comes from in the Gospel of Matthew. It's chapter 6, it's part of the Sermon on the Mount. Which is, the Sermon on the Mount, we could spend, just as Jeff Staley, folks in the morning are working with the Gospel of John, just the Sermon on the Mount itself is often grounds for extensive discussion. There's a lot in there about how we as Christians should act. This is chapter 6, verses 24, just verse 24. No one can serve two masters, for a slave will either hate the one and love the other, or be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. Now, if we read this passage only, the answer to our question today is no, and we can sort of end the section. And the question then is, which one?
It depends if you think for different things.
Right.
You may not be different masters.
Yeah. Wealth is not patriotism.
Mm-hmm. Good, good. I can see we already are moving right into the discussion. And so, what I thought we would do today is look at patriotism as one of those words, those catchwords, in our society, as in many societies, that are bantered around and used in a variety of ways, but without necessarily clarifying exactly what it means in each context. And in fact, as some folks have suggested already, the way it's used by different people may have completely different meanings. And how you or I would define patriotism may be very different from the person next to you, from people who are in our government. Patriotism is not unique to the United States or to any nation. And I just want to share two other thoughts about the fact that it's no accident this session is today, with July 4th coming up tomorrow, as a day of patriotism, of celebrating the birth of a nation. And I want you to think about, and we won't explore this in detail today, but just as a background of Native American peoples, Native American nations, and what does July 4th mean for them? So when we talk about a cause for celebration and think of that day, within the African American community, it's also an ambiguous day. So just, I want you to sort of keep those communities in mind as we go through our discussion. The other little sort of tidbit I want to throw out, yesterday I talked about Martin Luther King's birthday being the January 15th, also the deadline for starting a war. November 28th or 9th, I never remember the exact dates, which is the date that the United Nations passed the resolution authorizing force by any means to remove Iraq from Kuwait, is the day that Palestinians celebrate their independence. It's the International Day of Solidarity with the people of Palestine. And again, for people marginalized and experiencing the lack of statehood in some sense, and nation, how does that feel? So I just want us to begin to think about these rituals, secular rituals, which is just like our liturgical calendar, are important, and it's important to pause. So I'm really pleased that we can take this time today, as well as tomorrow in the various forms of celebration, the parade, etc., to reflect in slightly different ways, as well as traditional ways with fireworks and other things, that our country is want to do. And what I'd like to do is I put patriotism and dissent up there, and I think it's important for us to define them a little bit. And just think for a minute, what does it really mean to be patriotic? And I want to put it in the active sense as opposed to an ism, to say, what, when you think of patriotism, patriots, patriotic, what comes to mind? And then we'll do the same thing with dissent. And so what I'd like to do is if folks could take just a moment to think about those terms, and then turn to the person next to you and share briefly what's the image that comes to mind for you in terms of to be patriotic? What does that mean? So just take a moment of silence to think about that, and then turn to the person next to you or agree. So. I want to try and get a few of these up on the board so we can begin to define patriotism a bit. So what were some of the things that folks came up with as it meant to be patriotic?
At the very, very extreme, my country right or wrong.
Okay. Others?
Duty.
Okay.
He said duty.
Duty, okay.
Thankfulness that we're in the country we are.
Thankfulness, okay. Others?
The festivities associated with parade.
Okay. I'm just going to put parades. How about that?
Flag waving.
Flag
waving.
Flag. Just put flags. So.
Oh, anthems.
Chauvinism.
Anthems. Okay, we're getting into. Chauvinism.
Dying for your country.
Dying.
Jingoism.
Jingoism.
I don't remember what jingoism means.
What is slogans?
Super patriotism, I guess.
I think my father was very patriotic, and he was a Danish immigrant. And he realized what this country gave him, what opportunities he had here. compared to what he would have in Denmark. And he passed that on to his family. And what was always willing to take any civic job that he, you know, volunteered for.
That's why I said
thank appreciate, you. Yes.
Thankfulness, okay.
My family put down participation, meaning thinking in terms of participation, yeah. Civic.
Civic participation. How about civic participation? Civic,
yeah.
Is it unpatriotic to say, well, I wouldn't mind living in some other country?
Well, anybody who's a missionary has in some sense made that choice, at least for us.
But or to live in that country and become a citizen.
Right.
Is that unpatriotic?
You're being patriotic to the country you're going to.
No, you'll have to be.
Well, that gets at is there only one, I mean, the assumption of most countries is that our patriotism, our national identity is patriotism and the other country is something else. It's ethnic identity or...
When something happens in these other countries, they're very glad they are from the country they are because they're in there to help them move out of the situation.
Okay. Like put down loyalty already?
Oh, no, loyalty. Duty, I'll put that up. How about I put that, we're running out of space. It's not necessarily the duty and loyalty. Okay. Oh, so we have.
Is there a difference between patriotism and nationalism?
Oh, good question. We'll put that up here. We got the country, so we'll put nationalism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking of that too, because I would want to separate out my patriotism towards land and country versus my feelings for a nation state empire.
Okay, oh, good. Well, okay. Okay, so we got land and. Country, this
talk. Yeah, include the people. Yeah.
And then we'll, people.
Yeah.
And then the other part was, government is a good summary of nation state, nation empire, state. Government,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or empire.
Yeah.
Okay.
Patriotism doesn't have to be country right or wrong. Can't you be very patriotic and love your country? And if you see a wrong, you can say, hey, this is my country, I want to make it better, so I want to.
Yesterday we talked about the my country right around me is the love it or leave it or stay and make it better. Maybe we can put so.
Well, some countries have what they call the loyal opposition.
Okay, we got loyalty and maybe we'll put loyal.
I don't know if that's with tongue in cheek.
I think loyal opposition probably is in the defensive.
Yeah.
Well, we'll put it in the middle. How about that?
You care enough to stay.
Can it not be that some of the most patriotic things we've done is to be involved in dissent? I need a balance.
Let me warn you, this was a false dichotomy.
For me, it really is, and that's why I said that. Yeah,
but one has to be provocative in some ways. So. If I frustrated people, then maybe that's gotten us thinking about the terms. So. Okay, anything else for patriotism?
Well, the patriotism also would be heritage, kind of like you were saying, passing on the heritage.
Mm-hmm. I think there's definitely way.
The founding fathers.
Yeah, we got founding fathers.
We did have founders. Well, our country was started because we were all under oppression, and this is. They came because they were in jails or for religious reasons or whatever to come to this country, so they wouldn't be able to do the things that they wanted.
So in some sense, the initial patriotism may be a response to oppression. Would King George have described George Washington as a patriot?
No.
See, I mean, this is part of my point of that these terms, depends who's doing the defining, and probably a number of things on this side of the list, depending on who you're asking. Some folks would put half of this list over here and they said that's really dissent. And some other folks would take the exact opposite half of the list and say, no, this is the stuff that's really dissent. So we, now what about dissent? What are some images of dissent that folks have?
Flag burning,
okay.
People say that's free speech.
Supreme Court says it's free speech.
Well, is
free speech and dissent necessarily different?
No.
Sit-ins?
I mean, no,
it can be.
It may or may not. Sit-ins? Okay.
Peace parades.
Yeah, run good in other countries.
Okay, peace.
Andy Ward parades.
Peace-nits.
Parades.
Demonstration.
Acting on conscience.
Conscience.
Objectors. Yeah,
conscience.
Holden's 4th of July.
Put this okay, right? How about right here, Holden? We try and be humble in our assessment of. Okay, there were some others that folks said that I missed because I was writing here.
Protest.
Okay. Draft card burning. Okay, that's right. There's the whole anti-war. How about next to conscience? Here we got anti-war. I don't abbreviate COs. Draft card.
Taps broken.
Burning.
How about echo sabotage?
Strikes. Echo sabotage. Okay. What?
What? Tree spiking.
Tree spiking. Echo sabotage. Anything else?
Change agents.
Okay. So dissenters, in some sense, as opposed to patriots.
You have dying for on that side, too.
Dying for?
A lot of those can go on both sides.
Right.
How about assassins?
Again, it depends on who's doing it.
Assassins? Someone say it was a vote for terrorism?
Both sides.
We got loyal opposition in the middle, and we got terrorists. Or terrorism. No, we're redefining a lot of terms here. Okay, someone else wants to take the middle here.
Whistleblowers,
okay.
Oh, like Ralph Nader. Whoa.
Okay, anything else? I know we could probably spend all morning just sort of running down the list. Mafia, we'll put the mafia in the middle, or?
Heroes,
okay.
Heroines?
I'm just gonna have to.
Alright, now we got another fight going here. Way to go.
All right. Well, you know, there's the
uniforms on Patriot and just rags on the sins.
Right, instead of rags to riches, it's rags to uniforms. So. Okay, we got uniforms. Rags. Okay, I think.
Laundry.
Okay. I hope this is, you know, like getting a lot of words up here doesn't necessarily do anything. It gets more confusing. But my point in trying to pose these two, not necessarily as mutually exclusive, but as different, is how often in our society do we. You know, there's obviously, if we start putting value judgments on these, some of these terms we would define as negative. No one wants to say, yes, I'm proud to be a terrorist. But you would be proud to be...
Would they
define themselves as a terrorist, though?
I think some of the Palestinians would, sure.
And how about the Ku Klux Klan? Sure, they're proud.
Both. I mean, they could admit they're terrorists, but if they're picked heroes,
that's going to be an
But look at
Ku Klux Klan. They say they're the ultimate patriots.
Most folks would describe, you know, interesting, we use tend to see positive connotations to describing ourselves, whatever it is we're doing. And negative descriptions for others.
Yeah. 60 Minutes had a thing on that where they sat right there and said they were terrorists, they were being paid, and they were interviewed.
Who?
The Ku Klux Klan?
No, terrorists.
Palestinians?
Yeah. What I want to focus on is, if we go back to this passage of can we serve two masters, I want to get to that, so the priorities of some of these things, and sorting out, particularly in light of the Gulf War, sort of the context in which this is emerging most immediately for us, I think, and the 4th of July, in some sense now, we can, and the victory parades we had back in June in Washington and New York, but also the victory parades that have been going on all spring in most cities except Seattle. For those of you in Seattle, the battle is still raging in some...
Lots of the bureaucracy.
Yeah. Does someone want to say, for folks who are not from Seattle, what? Who's from Seattle here? A couple of folks. Someone want to just say something about the parade that, and what the...
Well, they originally had a parade scheduled, and supposedly the military and peace groups were all going to be in it, and there weren't going to be weapons in it. And then the original promoter, was a private promoter, ran out of money, couldn't raise enough, and the parade was canceled. And so then the city decided that they would mix it in with their seafair parade, which happens every year anyway. And then they got in this big flop again of whether the military should carry weapons or not. Somebody pointed out that they'd marched in seafair for many years and never carried weapons. But now they're insisting they have to carry weapons. And the last I heard, the whole thing is still up in the air as to whether or not they're going to have a parade.
Mm-hmm. Well, they have a parade, but
they'll have a seafair parade. Yeah. Whether it will also commemorate the Gulf veterans is up in the air.
That was parodied in the San Francisco paper. Somebody did something, so they changed it, so they did something else, so they changed it, and the last cartoon was, so San Francisco.
What's interesting about that is think about, when you have a real, obviously there's two sides there, and they're very, is there a sense that, if you look at these terms and how they're used, the folks who were criticizing the parade and saying there shouldn't be weapons, was anyone saying to them, you're being too patriotic? Come on, it's just a celebration, let's be real. People like guns. Patriotism does not have its place here. Is that the line that would be given to you?
No.
You see, suddenly the way patriotism gets defined is to isolate a group as being somehow not a part of what's really good. Of somehow being a naysayer, casting doubt on a good moment, and it's a real negative judgment. On the other side, they might also say the folks who are doing this are really just trying to serve their own corporate interests. I know in New York, an interesting thing happened. It was technically a non-profit parade. The city helped provide cleanup, but the money was all donated from private causes that were tax deductible. Although the military was certainly there on company time in some sense. So it was federal tax dollars as well. But the local media in New York, the newspapers and almost all the local dailies and the local TV stations contributed $25,000 or more to the parade that they then covered all day. And in one case with CBS and the Daily News, one of the daily papers in New York, jointly made a videotape of the parade, which that evening on the news they advertised that you could buy this tape to commemorate the parade. And then also had a news spot on that. I mean, it was not just an ad in between news, it was also a news spot where the anchorman, because he's an anchorman, was announcing, we've just made this video. And there was some
enterprise.
And so what's interesting here is to always ask, what's actually happening here, and when do labels like patriotism, and I want to suggest one of the issues here, why it's sort of confusing, is that these are labels. And we use labels to deny the legitimacy, the humanity of someone else that we don't agree with on all sides. We all do that. And so what's important is to identify when is it we're using labels. Communism, capital. I mean, we can take your pick. on either side of the fence, on many sides of the fence, but when is it that we label someone, and particularly in terms of the war, labeling folks patriotic and certain things patriotic mobilizes people, gets folks to do a certain thing, but then you also need to label someone else as an enemy. To have dissenters that are also considered patriots, blurs the issue. And so what I want to suggest is maybe a lot of the terms should sort of be in the middle. And it really depends on our values. And that's why I want to go back to this passage. It's just one passage, but it says, no one can serve two masters. And of course, the image that Jesus is using here is in slavery. And it's important for us, particularly acknowledging that July 4th was certainly not independence for most of the people living on this continent. And that our Constitution started with the right to vote for white male property owners. Yeah. If you were a white male and did not own property, you were not able to vote either. But it says here, no one can serve two masters, for a slave will either hate the one and love the other, or be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. And the key thing I want to raise here is that
we need to go on to say, he said also, to give to Caesar the things that were Caesar's, and the things to God that are God's.
The word I want to focus on here, and we'll get to that, because what happens invariably in all of this is we start, you know, because as churches and as religious people, we need to focus on, you know, we sort of, churches are in the midst of all this, and the folks that this morning heard the war prayer to Mark Twain, it's a very powerful prayer, and it's every bit as relevant for any war in terms of what happens when you pray at wartime for the safety of your own troops. What does that mean for the enemy, fellow human beings? The word I want to focus on here is love. And ask instead of what is it, duty or loyalty, or some of the actions here, what is it that we love? And do we define patriotism by what we love? Define dissent by what, as actions related to what we love. Now there's lots of passages, and I want to get to the issue of, how do we interpret scripture like render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, render to God the things that are God's. There's many interpretations of that. There's also passages like Romans 13, be subject to government authority. What does that mean? 1 Peter says, slaves, be obedient to your masters, even and especially when they're unjust. So there's a lot. Wives, be submissive to your husbands. I mean, you can go on down the list of various forms of acknowledging authority in the Bible and say, do we all follow those? Or necessarily, if we follow them, how does one interpret them? They're not all necessarily so easily. But I want to stop and ask you a question as to, you know, from now, where we go. I'm a little flexible. If folks are interested in looking at more specifically some of these biblical themes, I'm willing to go that way if folks are interested. I've got a list of a variety of biblical passages. But I think there's also a lot in terms of our own community and things that we've done. I know many folks have participated in vigils, sit-ins, etc., both in the past few months as well as before that. On lots of issues, and it's important to talk about those forms of dissent, which are also, I think, in many ways, patriotic. So where would folks, let me just check in now, where would folks like to go at this point? What would be most helpful or interesting? What are you struggling with?
Go where you were going.
Should we keep going?
Okay. Yeah. You bet.
I want to, okay, what I'd like to do is suggest, is it okay if I erased our, got our list here? You got to memorize. Yeah, there's going to be a test at the end of the week. So for those who are... by and large, always defined it in negative terms. Looking at this theme of love, and I want to suggest another word here and see what might happen if we put this other word here in terms of what is it that we love and what is it that Jesus calls us to. And it seems to me that throughout the Gospels and the New Testament, what Jesus calls us to is discipleship. Now I want to sort of ask, in some ways, what are the similarities and the differences between being a patriot and being a disciple? I mean, in some sense, we could have posed that as some of the tension there and asked that. Because discipleship calls for allegiance, a pledge of allegiance, maybe even, in our affirmation of faith. It calls for obedience to authority. And that's another, in addition to love, I'm going to put some basic things here. Obedience to authority.
Who is the authority, though?
Good question. And we got to this yesterday, the last couple days of, you know, the just war theories. Throughout the Bible, there's all sorts of questions throughout Christian tradition, the denominations, in terms of our institutional structure, governments. There's always a question of authority. What is a legitimate authority? What makes for authority that should call for and demand obedience? And that we should want to be obedient. God's authority, I mean, most of us as Christians, as other religious people, feel that God's authority is somewhat important. But there's a range of other authorities. It's not just one singular. And I don't know, folks who were here yesterday remembered Max Weber's definition of the state, which I think is very important here, because patriotism, you can't talk about it without talking about nations, countries, is organized and legitimate, in effect, a legitimate authority, use of coercion, force, and violence. That if that's how you define the state...
Say that again.
It's the organized and legitimate use of coercion, force, and violence. In other words, the police. If I go out and shoot you, I have to, in some sense, prove that it was self-defense. A police officer carrying a gun, the assumption is that the police officer is justified in using that gun, whereas the assumption, if I use it, is that I'm not justified in using it until I sort of... You see the difference there?
I wouldn't say that. Because if a policeman shoots somebody, they are put on suspension until they can prove that they had a reason for shooting that gun.
Well, that's, not really true. Well, I mean, they're not put on suspension unless there's some suspicion and they're reviewed by usually a civilian complaint board, which is constituted usually in most cities in this country by the police department. So it's really an internal review.
It is. They are not put back on. It's without pay.
No, that's not true. No. It depends on...
I would disagree. My husband's been a law enforcement for 30 years.
What town?
Colville, Washington. He was a state parole and probation officer for the state of Washington.
Okay. Well, I don't know... I won't speak for Washington, but I do know in New York that they're suspended with pay if they're suspended.
Los Angeles, too.
Mm-hmm. Until proven guilty, because you're assumed innocent. I mean, the assumption is...
Well, true. No, but they usually, they take themselves off of working or suspension or whatever you want until they can prove that you can go back.
Okay, I think we may need to hold, call time on our disagreement, which is good. But the point that I want to make there is that Police, in some sense, is an arm of the state. The military is an arm of the state. Tax collectors, you know, one of the favorite images of the IRS. I mean, and no one up here said joyfully pay taxes as what it means to be a good patriot. We've got some questions here, you know. I've got a few. Yeah, I know what it is. We just didn't have time for it. You know, and I know we're all absolutely honest. But you see, you know, how we're selective in our appropriation. But the point here is that I want to highlight in terms of some themes is the obedience to authority. And whenever you say something like that, it calls up, well, what authority? Which authorities? And when you turn to scripture, as when you turn anywhere else, you're in trouble. Because it's pretty confusing as to which authorities, you know, the render to Caesar the things that are Caesar and to God the things that are God. Well, if you render everything to God that belongs to God, which is the whole inhabited earth, what's left for Caesar? If you start by rendering things to Caesar, do you have enough left to render to God? Or is really rendering to God those spiritual things, you know, are matters of faith in terms of eternal life and all the public affairs of our public organized life really go to Caesar.
But didn't Christ say that statement about rendering to Caesar while he was looking at a coin and saying, yes, pay the taxes, Peter?
Well, no, he didn't say pay the taxes.
Well, he said give this.
We're interpreting it.
Well, but we need to, what's interesting is suppose you could, and this is just hypothetical, what some folks have said is the role of Caesar, the role of government is to provide healthcare, to provide mail service, to provide, trash collection, clean the streets when there's snow. And as long as Caesar's doing that, we should certainly render to Caesar those functions that appropriately belong to the government. When Caesar goes out and decides to wage wars we disapprove of, or take money from the poor and give to the rich, or whatever Caesar might be doing that we don't think really is Caesar's, then we need to not answer that. So it's ambiguous. I don't want to get bogged down just on that one passage. The other piece that I want to push here that I think we need to really examine in relation to the whole realm of patriotism and how dissenters, particularly in a crisis time of war, are labeled, is conformity. And for this, I'll do a little proof texting myself here. In Luke chapter 12, there's an interesting passage here. This is verse 51 in chapter 12. Do you think that I have come to bring peace to the earth? Talking about war and peace, right? And Jesus is the peacemaker. No, I tell you, but rather division. And in Matthew, it's the sword. I'm not to bring peace, but the sword. I use this translation of Luke because it strikes me, and it goes on to say, a family of five would be divided, three against two, two against three. That Jesus divides people, does not push for conformity. And what I want to suggest is by peace here, that we often, again, blur two distinctions, which is related to this, is that is peace an effort at all costs to make sure that we all are at one? A sort of premature reconciliation of disguising any differences, of saying, yes, we all agree because we're all good, loving people. What do you do when you sit down in a room and now, what's your name again?
Jane.
Jane and David, we sit down and we have a disagreement over facts and experiences, etc. The temptation, I think, for many of us as Christians to say, oh no, but you know, we're brothers and sisters in Christ and you know, it's just a confusion of facts and I'm sure if we sit down, it's all fine. And at the end of the session, we'll all sing, we're all Christians by our love, and everything will be better. Rather than saying, we have a major disagreement, but we are still brothers and sisters. What do we do with that? And Jesus basically says, I came to bring exactly that kind of division. which is hard for us, I think, particularly white middle-class Americans, to acknowledge. If one is Native American, one's experienced division and ostracism in this society a lot. So it's not new. If one's black, if one's poor, you've experienced being outcast, being seen as the black sheep of the family or whatever. For those of us who are white and middle class, and particularly the males who happen to be in that category, we're sort of comfortable, business as usual. We feel the world is there for at our disposal. We can sort of do what we want to do, and you know, our faith fits with our country, and you know, we oppose certain things, but you know. And this reconciliation thing of conformity is really hard. It's very hard to acknowledge that Christ came to divide us in some sense, or to, I would say, acknowledge the divisions that were already there. To just bring those to the surface. And what happens in a time of crisis is those folks get labeled as the centers in a negative way. You're hurting unity, and at the time of crisis we need to pull together, work in common. And there's no time, in effect, for debate. There's no time for democracy. When you get to the public political thing here, is we what we're in effect saying is when we push for conformity, and I would say the peace movement often does this too. It's not we don't have nearly as much power to enforce that in some sense. But think of different experiences in the peace movement of when folks really disagree on strategies. Should we have a sit-in? Should we burn draft cards? Should we commit civil disobedience, or no, we need to really have a silent vigil. There was, with these parades in New York, there was a real struggle within the anti-war community. And I know in Seattle, the same thing. What's appropriate? How do we honor and, in effect, celebrate that certain people's lives were spared from the tragedy of war? That certainly calls for celebration, that people did come home and were not killed or wounded. But how do we at the same time mourn and express our outrage at the incredible devastation that took place and not just celebrate military hardware, but celebrate humanity? And there was an agreement. I mean, some folks felt there was no way to celebrate, that it was all atrocious. And others felt, well, wait a minute, the troops that are marching down those streets, 30% of them are African American. This is probably one of the only times that the whole community is going to come out and celebrate them. And when they step out of the armed forces, where is that celebration, where is that honor going to be? And certainly for anyone who's a Vietnam veteran or knows Vietnam veterans, the experience of fighting in a war they didn't necessarily want to fight in, or they did want to fight in, but coming back to a society that then saw them as lepers, that we can't, you know, it's acknowledge that there are deep divisions in our community, in the human community. And patriotism, as a when it functions as a label, is usually to deny any of those divisions or say, I'm right and you're wrong.
Like I would never carry a gun, but it's still my country, but I would serve in the MASH unit, taking care of those that have been hurt in it.
There's a range. There are other folks who would never, not only never carry a gun, but would not feel serving in any role in the military is participating in that system.
I feel as a nurse, it's healing.
One thing that's interesting is I think a lot of us in the room would say we have negative connotations with the word patriotism, but I'm seeing a lot of similarities between patriotism and community, which we all think is so wonderful, and but there's a lot of similarities between what we're talking about, this idea of conformity and stuff within community as well. So it's a label that we can use.
Well, think about
patriotism.
Think about the bell. you know, and we all love the bell, right? I mean, there's no problem, and everybody arrives on the same time. But what are the looks that happen if someone happens to trickle in 5 minutes late to something? And you know, take your pick. I think that's an excellent point of that. Many of us are devoted to intentional community, coming together and working cooperatively, working by consensus. And yet part of that consensus building can easily slip into conformity building. And denying that there's one person here who says, I just don't think this is a good way of doing things. I love all of you, but I don't think this is a good, and I want to talk about that. And the frustrations of, well, we don't have time to talk about this now. We've got 15 other things to do the rest of the day. And in order to get those 15 things done, you need to just sort of come along. And I understand, we all make our rationalizations. So that, thank you, that's an excellent point.
I was thinking that discipleship implies, at least if you look at the Jesus disciples, struggling with teaching, mm-hmm. and maybe not always understanding, but sort of reflecting on what that teaching is. It seems to me that reflection is a really important aspect of being a citizen. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we haven't talked yet about what it means to be a citizen. And let me ask, how many folks in the room are Lutheran? Okay. Got a major...
Are you taking names?
No, we're taking names. Luther has something in his theology which has been a potential stumbling block. I at least want to, as a non-Lutheran, highlight that for you. just so that we won't feel that I'm pressuring anyone along these lines. And it goes back prior to Luther to St. Augustine or Augustine. And that's the theology of two kingdoms. That there's a kingdom of this world. Now, wait, I'm having a little trouble spelling here. Kingdom. Two kingdoms, sort of the world and God's kingdom. There's different names. Augustine's City of God was there's two cities. And what I think is interesting is that we use secular terms to describe the two realities. Augustine saw the city as the most advanced form of human organization. And so the city of God and the city of man, humanity, the world. Luther talked about two kingdoms. And one of the dangers of this is to separate out that we all have two selves, in effect, a private self and a public self. And in our private affairs, we need to be pious and Christian and whatever. And in our public affairs, we need to be realistic. So we have, sort of realism, realist versus Christian.
This is Augustine talking?
Well, these are
all...
This is Wilder talking? This is a modern paraphrase of Augustine and Luther.
Wow. Augustine would state how it ought to be. That was the ideal, and then he's saying this is the way it is, so you better take it. And I think that's what he's capturing.
In other words, this kingdom, in some sense, is not yet. It's in process. It's in the midst of, and Augustine and Luther are quite clear, no human being can separate them and say, oh, well, I'm part of the kingdom of God, and I don't know what you're doing, but you're a mess. You're over there in the world. None of them say that definitively. He says only God knows what is, in effect, the city of God in process and emergence within the city of humanity or man at that point, or the kingdom of the world. They're mixed together until the end times. The point here, however, is that this theology, which initially saw them as intermingled, led itself very easily to, as modern Western society emerged and the church became more and more privatized, as opposed to the Middle Ages when the church was the government, in effect, in Europe. And so government was sort of the realm of secular, you know, that Christians served in government, but we sort of, our Christian ethics weren't, you know, were on our, in our pocket or whatever. And there became a split as to which teachings of the gospel were most relevant for the private life and which were public life. And that's where suddenly Romans 13 became very important, to be subject to authority. Now the interesting thing is, if you look at forms of dissent that folks mention, like sit-ins, the civil rights movement in the 60s was entirely subject to authority. They served their time in jail, but they refused to obey. And that's what I wanted, you know, again, in some sense you could say that they were obedient to a higher authority, and Martin Luther King and others were quite clear that we will not reject and attack the authority of the government. We will be subject to it, but we will be civilly disobedient in order to be obedient to a higher authority. Rarely do we sort of think about being subject to authority, and those, that doesn't necessarily mean doing everything the authority says. But it, so it does suggest room for a sort of nonviolent resistance. It does call into question armed resistance to some degree, although other folks have said that that passage in Romans, if you read the surrounding text, is very unclear what it means. Paul, right before that, is saying, resist evil. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed. This is in chapter 12, right before. Be transformed by the renewal of your mind, so that you may be perfect. And if you're not going to be conformed to this world, and then and you're loving people, including your enemies, and then the authorities that you're supposed to be subject to are telling you to kill your enemies, you know, I mean, Paul's legacy to us is very contradictory, and I think we just need to acknowledge that turning to one passage or another in Scripture, as I said earlier, is not going to solve our problems. It's going to lead into more trouble. And that's why I want to highlight these sort of issues of, like, we'll always ask, what authority are we talking about? Why is that authority illegitimate? Is it just because it happens to have more power? You know, in that sense, if we are really to be obedient to authority, then the Iraqis were supposed to do what they were doing, you know, and should obey Hussein because he's the legitimate authority, right? I don't buy that, and I, you know, George Bush on that thing was wrong to call on Iraqis to rebel, because that's not respecting an authority, because all authority comes from God. You see? Mm-hmm. If you take the scenarios we wouldn't normally like to take, we get into trouble with those texts. And that's what I want to encourage you to do, is always push those interpretations. And when folks start saying, well, wait a minute, what about, and you've got, you know, I've got my verse in my pocket, it says, do not kill, you know, or obey authority. Question that, and that's where Jesus' divisions is just acknowledging that we're wrestling with these issues constantly, and there's not a simple answer. And I know from my work in the peace community, many, you know, a pacifist position is often equally simplistic, of saying, of course it's simple. The whole Christian message is do not kill. So we can just look. Are you killing? You carrying the gun? Wrong. End of discussion. So just stop and doing that, and you'll be okay. I want to suggest that, as hard as it is, that's not an appropriate approach. That for us, I consider myself someone deeply grounded in the peace movement, but I wrestle with struggles of liberation, the folks who choose to take up arms. How does one engage and talk to those folks? And I think one of the most important things is not letting those divisions keep us from talking to one another, and acknowledging what caused those divisions and how we might heal them in a genuine fashion. Well, let me see. Are there any questions, comments, thoughts that all this has evoked? We're just about out of time.
There are lots of kinds of authority, too. We we've talked about the government authority today, but there are times in our history when the major authority was the church, and some horrible things were done under that interpretation of God's authority. And that may not be over yet.
I think one thing, as we think about tomorrow, that I want to urge you to, that I think is one, what I found is one of the most helpful things for dealing with authorities, is to distinguish between two things, and the biblical tradition is quite clear about this, is promise and practice. If you look at the ancient Israel, God promised them a land, that they were a chosen people, that they would be blessed, but all of that promise was contingent upon ongoing practice of following God, God's way. And Jesus constantly is saying, if, you know, if you want to follow me, you must, XYZ, you know, take my yoke upon you. The burden is easy, but it's always following, because yokes are designed for oxes to follow the direction. And what happens is when the promise of a new nation, of independence, of struggling against the tyranny of a king, moves over to disguise current practices. And so we refuse to acknowledge where we are and use our own promise, which itself was not the reality at the time. And that's what I want to distinguish, is that the promise of an independent United States, of the Declaration of Independence, of we the peoples of the United States, the beginning of the U.S. Constitution, there's a lot of things in that. The Declaration of Independence is a powerful document, and that if you look at the practices at the time, there were a lot of problems, and it did not mean everybody when they were talking. And yet there was in that a promise that went beyond their present practices. And that's the same with the whole biblical witness, that there's a promise constantly that Israel is called to a greater practice, a greater reality, and that in the future, what one goes back to is that use that promise as a check on our current practice, not to disguise it. And that's what, you know, because what often happens is, you know, we attack someone who's dissenting, or we feel attacked, and they say, you're not patriotic, you don't believe in the Declaration of Independence, you know, we sort of, well, yes, in fact, I do believe in that, and I just think it needs to go further. And I'll close with a quote from Gandhi, which I think is an interesting one. He was he went on a trip to England one time, and was traveling around with some journalists, which was early in his career, and they showed him Westminster Abbey and all the major sites in London and around the universities and government, etc. And they said, well, Mr. Gandhi, what do you think of Western civilization? And his response was, I think it would be a good idea. And what he was clear on was the promise of Western civilization, but certainly not its practice as he experienced it at the margins of that. So what I would urge all of us to think of tomorrow and every day is that distinction between, you know, in other words, what do you think of the United States of America? It would be a good idea.
Thank you, David.
Thank you very much.
Where was my shirt first?
Coming out strong and not being impressive, not necessarily. I mean, I think they did not put strong on the wall. And it wasn't.
Wasn't there a platform? I mean, you said impressive. Yeah.
No, but the board of Bowman Ministries and the board of the pursuing, at least before the war started, pursuing sanctions more, and a variety of things like that. It's just the sense of falling on deaf ears in some sense, what I found interesting was that compared to Vietnam, the churches were, before the war even started, of course, you did have a different situation. There was 500,000 troops over there. And in Vietnam, we really trickled into it in a much different way.